show brought to you by the MVM Radio Network, home of LouisvillePolitics.com, where you can get all the latest news going on in Louisville, Kentucky, and around the world. Yes, LouisvillePolitics.com. You know, while you're there, by the way, join our RSS feed, click on our advertisers, do all of that good stuff. For you guys that are first-time listeners tonight via Stitcher Radio, you can call us at 858-683-1326 or at 502-805-0334. Those are the numbers we have every single night. They never change. And you can also IM, if you're on AOL at this time, you can also IM at myviewmatters@AOL.com or check us out on iTunes as well and all our later podcasts. For you regular listeners in the queue, you know to hit that little number one on your dial pad as you're listening to the show, and that lets me know you want to talk. For you guys who are new, hit the number one on the dial pad and lets me know you want to talk, and we'll get you on air. In the meantime, Ed Martin appears to be running a little bit late. I'm not sure what's up with that, but he should be joining us shortly. Not that that really matters. We never run out of stuff to talk about on this show. I tell you what, I want to start a little bit tonight with local issue. The local Louisville Water Company executive director Greg Heitzman has been serving in a dual role. He's been serving as the interim executive director with MSD for the last few months since they got rid of Bud Chardine, finally, after all these years of trying. And the audit that came out last year, I believe it was a year ago, damn near to the day, was a scathing audit of MSD. And there was about 150 things that they found wrong. Well, apparently they believe Greg Heisman has done his job, that he has fixed everything at MSD. He has completed the 150 state audit recommendations, corrected all the problems MSD had a year ago. And supposedly MSD is set to be one of the greatest things going in the world today. Not that we believe any of that, and I'll tell you why. You know, the big issue right now today currently with MSD isn't so much whether MSD is compliant or not. We know they're not in full compliance, regardless of what they're trying to sell us in the media. We've got too many examples of that. Are they doing it better? Yes. But you couldn't do much worse than what we had with Jerry Abramson pulling the strings of Bud Chardine as his director. The problem right now that I see going forward, and what's really going to be an interesting situation here, is the merger potential between Louisville Water Company and MSD. The major problem with MSD has been, and always has been, or will be, their debt. The debt at MSD has just been unsustainable. Well over $3.2 billion, more to come by the time we consider the $800 million that they have to borrow to satisfy the voluntary compliance that Bud Chardine entered into with the EPA consent decree, is going to basically put our debt up over $4 billion, which is exactly what it was costing in other cities around the country, like Birmingham, Alabama, for example, which is also ironically Jefferson County. It bankrupted their city, their MSD debt. What brings that so important is because they are so closely aligned with the size and the scope of what we do here. How does Louisville Water Company fit into this play? Well, MSD is one of these quasi-public-private situations, call it what you want to. They essentially raise their rates up to 6% every year because they don't have to have any approval to do so. They're not have any oversight by the PSC or the Public Service Commission here in Kentucky, which is alarming to most of us. It's one of the things that a lot of us have been advocating for a long time, is that they must have some oversight because at this point they don't. So the Louisville Water Company comes into play because the Louisville Water Company is actually a private corporation. But ironically, 100% of all the stock is owned by none other than the city of Louisville. So the city of Louisville owns the Louisville Water Company lock, stock, and barrel, except it's considered a private company because we own the water company through shares of stock. Now, why is this something? Well, the reality is the water company makes, you know, millions of dollars every year. The water company makes millions of dollars every year in profit. And they take those millions of dollars and they give it to the city of Louisville, who in turn uses that for public services, police, fire. Think about it. We pay taxes for those services. Now, the Louisville Water Company, who makes a profit every year and increases their profit every year, also increases their rates just about every year. So what happens here is the city of Louisville says they need more money. So the water company raises their rates, and the city of Louisville makes more money on the back end because of their stock ownership in Louisville Water Company, the 100% ownership we have. What this is to me and many others is simply taxation without representation. This is nothing but a backdoor tax. We already pay taxes to provide for public safety services. We already pay taxes to provide for what we're supposed to be having in Louisville. But we use the Louisville Water Company to increase their rates to get more revenue for the city of Louisville without calling it a tax. That way they bypass everything that's required to get a tax. That's a scary proposition, folks. And when you see MSD talking about going with the water company, it's because MSD has an unsustainable debt. They continue feeding us this line about their debt structure and they're okay, and that's garbage. Ever heard of LIBOR, illegal interest rate swaps, JP Morgan Chase? Those are the same things that we've done right here in Louisville that bankrupted Birmingham, Alabama, and is on the verge of bankrupting many other municipalities across the country because of the illegal bank dealings that we've entered into the same contract agreements on. There is no way that this debt is sustainable. So what do? You don't want any oversight, because if you get oversight, you have accountability. We don't want to go under the Public Service Commission where the rules are a little bit tighter and we have to pay attention to what's going on. So what do? You merge MSD with Louisville Water Company. You call it a private business. They can continue to raise rates at will. They can continue giving extra money to the city of Louisville every year. And we're not talking about, $5, $6 million, folks. We're talking about tens of millions of dollars minimum that they turn over to the city every year in excess fee increases. They give it to the city. The city calls it profits on their stock. The city uses that for public services. So we're, in effect, being taxed. Taxed. For what? Nobody can seem to tell me that. Nobody can answer the question of how are they getting away with this. So that's the big issue with Greg Heisman taking over as the executive director of MSD. He's expected to be fully in that role by May the 1st. They're actively seeking a so-called executive director for the Louisville Water Company once Heisman makes a complete 100% switch. But this is nothing. I mean, this is a no-brainer. We knew Heisman was a permanent choice when they picked him to be a temporary choice months ago. We knew that the deal was to set Greg Heisman up. He knows Louisville Water Company, how it runs. Now he knows how MSD runs. Now they make the argument that, wow, we've got a guy that can merge this seamlessly, and he can make the merger happen, and everybody's going to be happy, and we get this kumbaya moment. It's a joke. It is a joke. We can't get a kumbaya moment when we're still dealing with illegal backdoor taxes. And that's exactly what they've done by installing Greg Heisman here. And we've got to pay attention to that going forward, and trust me, we will. Check out LouisvillePolitics.com or go to EdSpringston.com and just type in the search boxes MSD, and you'll see the big story behind MSD and what's really going on with the money and why it's bankrupting different municipalities around the country. Check out the Louisville Water Company, and you'll see how the illegal tax scheme works. It is phenomenal what these guys get away with. One other thing here in the state, before we start really moving on to national issues, one other thing going on in the state right now is Bullock County. Yep, Bullock County is just the latest who's trying to impose a smoking ban. Now, you wouldn't think this would be such a big deal. We've been down this road so many times. Everybody and their brother wants to institute a smoking ban. Never mind that there is no science that has proven any of the charges that these guys continue claiming out of these health departments. They haven't proven anything when it comes to secondhand smoke, but they continue using it as a catalyst, but they just don't like the smell of it. Okay, fair enough. We know these things. But the reality is Bullock County is taking this to the next level. In most cases, your legislature enacts a smoking ban. In this particular case, the Bullock County legislature did not enact a smoking ban. The Bullock County Board of Health decided they were going to enact a smoking ban without the lawmaker's support. So then we get into the legal boundaries, individual rights, blah, blah, blah. Well, lo and behold, the courts have sided against the Bullock County Board of Health, except, you guessed it, the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals, the State Court of Appeals ruled 2-1 on Friday that the Bullitt County Board of Health has the authority to enact a smoking ban without lawmakers' support. Now I want to ask you guys something, because this is really serious to me. How can a Board of Health make a lawful decision telling you what you can and can't do without having a law to back it? How can they do that? You know, according to all of these different things going on, the board supposedly has the authority to impose regulations or ordinances involving public health. Now, if we were talking about some kind of an outbreak, you know, maybe there's a measles outbreak or some kind of a daggone terminal outbreak of some sort of disease somewhere, and they had to come in and use some temporary measures to you know, control of that aspect. You know, maybe we have to, you know, shut down, you know, this boundary from this line to this line, and everybody's got to stay contained, you know. We've got to contain this so-called hazardous situation until it's either resolved, you know, one way or the other. But in this situation, that isn't the case. That isn't the case. According to the Court of Appeals, the Board of Health appealed this to the Court of Appeals after losing twice. And according to the Court of Appeals, the majority of the appeals panel agreed on 3 points. They agreed that the board has the authority to impose regulations or ordinances involving public health. They said that secondhand smoke is a health issue, which has never been proven. And they also said that the ordinance, the way it was written, was reasonable. Now, what we've got here is we've got Dr. Swanee Jett. He's the Bullitt County Health Director. He said this case has always been about the public dangers of secondhand smoke. I say that as I'm lighting up my Marlboro. And then he had the science to back it up, including a 2006 from the U.S. Surgeon General, blah, 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 blah. The problem is that we've got a lot more to answer here than that, because we also have some different situations coming out of, you know, the U.S. government itself that doesn't quite agree with this. I mean, take, for example, OSHA. OSHA says it has jurisdiction over indoor air quality, and they basically said just a few years ago that according to Independent Public and Health Policy Research Group, a Littlewood and Fennel out of Austin, Texas, the secondhand smoke wasn't a problem because the PELs, which is what everybody uses as the determining factor on this, the PELs, which is permissible exposure levels, all right, in a room, don't even get approached by secondhand smoke. If you're in a small sealed room, 9x20, the following things must occur in 1 hour. For benzo, which is one chemical, there must be 222,000 cigarettes smoked in 1 hour in a 9x20 room. For acetone, 118,000 cigarettes. You can see where I'm going with this. For smoke, for arsenic and things like that, 2,500,000 smokers at one time. This is all in one sealed room for 1 hour, a 9x20 room, which is smaller than most of your bedrooms. This is when the chemicals would be at a point where we had to be concerned. So secondhand smoke has never been proven to be everything they want us to believe it is. However, you know, we've got these idiot appeals court judges, Michelle Keller and Lawrence Van Meter, and you guys need to remember those names because they need to be replaced in 2014 when they come up for re-election. When they come up for re-election, they need to go because they continue trying to do things from the bench that they don't have the legal right to do. The Board of Health cannot, the Bullitt County Health Department cannot tell a business how to run their business with a legal product. We have laws for that. The legislature in Bullitt County clearly chose not to make a smoking ban a priority. So who is the Board of Health to come in and make their own rules and their own laws? That's what drives me nuts. And the board basically is following a legal argument that came from a 1954 state law, yep, over 5 decades ago, that says it has the right to protect the health of the people. Now, I find that extremely funny. They may have to protect the rights of the people, like I said. We're talking about epidemics and things like that, which is what they should be taking care of, but not taking care of this stuff. This is crazy. We're going to take a quick break. We'll get back. We're going to switch gears. We'll get into a little bit more on the federal level. Because I tell you, I want to talk about this welfare spending, how much it really costs for welfare spending, what kind of losses we really get when we actually raise taxes instead of living within our means. And, you know, we'll get into a few other things as well. Listen to the Ed Springsteen Show right here on the MVM Radio Network. We'll be right back.
And a cold beer on a warm day. Some way I gotta make it happen, cause a dollar is worth nothing if you ain't got more to stack it in. Some say the facts don't lie, well my pockets are empty, my stomach's rumbling and my mouth is dry. Some say others pass by, but it's the ones that pass away that make us wanna stay alive. And so I say I cannot die, not why people rely on me to provide. And yes, I may stray from time to time, but my past always brought me back around to see the brighter side. I pray rainy days will stay away, because my umbrella is broken and the sunshine never stays. And so I lay my heart into every line, because without emotion I'm promoting nothing but these rhymes.
I know it's hard for you, you've been trying to make it right. I know it's hard for you when you can't sleep through the night. I know it's hard for you to see me look this way, but I promise you everything will be okay someday.
The days are getting longer and the world is getting colder. I've been feeling somber from the things that we've all been exposed. We're supposed to be searching for something we never really find, so we hustle and grind, trying to make ends meet all the time. I find the more you try, the more you fail, so either cry better to step off stage and give them hell. And mama, I know you're crying cause I'm out on my own. I can hear it in your voice when I'm calling you on the phone. But I'm not alone, trust me, know that I got a home. And yes, my girl left, but my heart will never be stone, so miss me, but please don't cry for me. When we get rich, you're gonna see how life can be. So let's rewind to a time when things were okay. Don't know I can make it happen, but I'll do what it takes. And know that I will always appreciate what you did for me. So keep looking forward to someday.
I know it's hard for you, you've been trying to make it right. I know it's hard for you.
Pound, extreme, my damn name's just for now. I'm getting paid big change, wondering how low, buddy change lanes. Everybody's trying to say that I couldn't make it this far. When they told me the ball, what you're looking at me for? I hope the sky, cause you found a star. You live for today, I live for tomorrow. For all time is the way we live in. Large channels, what I'm delivering. Hard times we live in, so my cash is hard pressed. In between the mattress is hidden, so I can guard it my best. So that one day, someday, we can survive like the rest.
I know it's hard for you. You've been trying to make it right. I know it's hard for you.
Welcome back to the Ed Springsteen Show right here on the MVM Radio Network. That song was a song called Someday by a local artist, starving artist, if you will, JT502. So if you guys want to copy that, let me know. Write to me at My View Matters, and I'll make sure I can get you one. You know, it's interesting because as I continue to talk about this Bullock County smoking ban, you know, there's a couple of things that people don't really realize. Before we move on, I just want to point this out. You know, there were smoking bans attempted 75 years ago. I mean, there were smoking bans attempted in 1901. 1901, folks. There was a strong anti-cigarette activity in 43 of the 45 states in 1901. Only Wyoming and Louisiana had stayed out of it. All the other states either had an anti-cigarette law on the books or were considering new ones. In 1904 in New York, a judge sent a woman to jail for 30 days for smoking in front of her children. That's where we're headed here, folks. We also had another situation in New York where a woman was arrested for smoking a cigarette in an automobile. 1907, businesses were refusing to hire smokers. 1917, tobacco control laws started going away, including the smoking bans, you know. And oh, by the way, in 1937, and I got to put this out there because this is exactly where I think we're going. In 1937, you know who instituted laws against smoking? Adolf Hitler. Now, I hate to use that term because everybody thinks that you're trying to blame Obama and all this other garbage all the time when you use that. But the bottom line is simple. We continue to give up our freedoms and our liberties every day. We're falling behind. And you know, we're supposed to be the defender of freedom in the nation or across the world. And we're giving up every freedom we've got right here at home. How does that make sense, folks? This is ridiculous. Let's go to the phones already. This looks like my good friend Paul is Stop It, Stop Invisible Taxes.
Well, hi, Ed. This is a new week. How's life treating you today?
Well, you know, I can actually hear myself this week, so that's the best it's been in over 3 weeks. So I guess things are going okay, man. How are you?
Well, doing pretty good. Now, for your listeners, they need to know that last week I really made your show more interesting than what you wanted me to make it in terms of a pretty serious disagreement with your position last week. But good news is that's all it was a disagreement.
It makes me all warm and fuzzy inside because it makes people realize I'm getting involved. Go ahead.
Well, tonight, related to your Bullitt County thing, there's a couple of other little quickie historical facts that I think pertain to the situation in Bullitt County. Ed, do you recall from your study of American history when the so-called Pilgrims actually landed on the shores of the East Coast? Do you remember about what year that was?
Oh, God. No, I really honestly don't.
It was 1620, according to the history book, 1620.
Okay.
And 1620, they almost died in their first year because they tried to use a form of socialism. And by the end of the first year over here, the captain, I think the guy's name was John Smith, said, no, this isn't working. And he ended up going to a form of living in which each individual had incentive to produce more from the land than for themselves, and if they produced more, then they could sell it. Okay, before it was kind of communal, so that didn't work out so hot. Well,
right.
one of the lessons from that era was that socialism was tried the first time that the Europeans landed foot on this continent, and it failed.
Mm-hmm.
It failed miserably. This thing that's going on in Bullitt County is very similar to another socialist experiment. Socialism is inherently doomed to fail no matter what form it takes. A friend of mine was telling me, we got into a lively discussion on that today, and she mentioned specifically, said, you know, socialism works. I said, no, it really doesn't work, because socialism depends upon something that has a limited duration, and that is, as long as you continue to take from those who have and redistribute to other groups of people, that only works for as long as those who have continue to have. Once they have had their stuff depleted, there's nothing else to take. And
let's be clear. I mean, let's make sure that the listeners understand. So when you're talking about socialism and the Pilgrims, what essentially happened was everything became communal property. So if you grew, you know, lettuce, for example, I don't know what they grew back then or what they did, but if you grew lettuce, for example, that went into a pool, so everybody shared everything. So there was no incentive to work whatsoever because
And that's
why
exactly
would you?
What Captain Yeah, that's what Captain John Smith ran into immediately within.
Well, that's what I want to make sure. That's what I want to make sure the listeners understand, because when we talk about the socialists and the communist stuff, I mean, I want to make sure they really get that clearly, because if this guy was a farmer and planted lettuce and tomatoes, and this guy was, you know, I don't know, a woodsmith who chopped trees, you know, what was the incentive to continue, you know, cutting trees to build houses with, you know, so you make your log cabins, or what was the incentive for, you know, a guy to grow out and grow vegetables if he's the only one doing it and he couldn't sell them on a market? Everybody just took what they wanted. Because ultimately you get people that don't want to do anything and they take from it, like you're talking about, the has versus the have-nots. And that's why they had to change that the following year, because they realized they couldn't make any money that way and everybody was starving to death.
No, it went way beyond just money.
Well, originally, I agree, they did do it for survival. But at the original idea here, if I remember my history right, you know, I was reading about this just a couple of months ago, but the original idea here was that you would pull everything into one communal system, okay, and then they would sell everything and everybody would make a profit. That would be an equal profit, but everybody would make money. But it didn't work that way.
Ed, there was no money to be had. They were the first Europeans on the continent. Okay, there was no money. Okay, they did it for survival.
No.
Okay, number two, the idea about not everybody pulling their own weight. Obviously, among all those early settlers, there were some slackers on board. Okay, there were some slackers. There were people who were quite content to be lazy bums and live off the productivity of others who were much more industrious. So Captain John Smith said, wait a minute, this isn't working so hot. So he gave the lazy bums an incentive. You want to eat, you have to go out and do it yourself. You get to eat what you want. You know, you eat as much as you want, but only based on what you grow. So they had a pretty powerful incentive for getting off that early socialism system. Okay.
Sure.
Another interesting little factoid from that period, which kind of applies to this whole Bullock County thing, has to do with government sticking its nose in where it doesn't belong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 1620, first settlers came and set foot on the east coast of the United States, right?
Right.
Okay. The first British governor wasn't assigned to the colonies until 1760. That's 140 years later. Now, Ed, how on earth did all of those people who came to the New World, how on earth did they survive for 140 years without the government telling them what to do?
You know, man, it just defies logic. It just defies logic, doesn't it?
And not only did they survive, but they had to get along with all them foreigners that they called Indians.
Right.
And you know, apparently they did survive. And they did find a way to coexist, although sometimes it wasn't peaceful, but many times it was. But they survived for 140 years without government.
Well, now here's where I get confused. Because, you know, to my understanding, and, you know, I don't claim to know everything, but to my understanding, you know, William Bradford was the governor for over 30 years. After the previous governor, John Carver was actually, I believe, the first governor. And once he died, then William Bradford took over. But William Bradford died in 1657. So the timing, I guess, is what I'm having a suspect with. From what I can gather here, John Carver was the first governor, but he died in April of 1621. And I believe that's when William Bradford took over. I may be wrong on that. But that's why I'm looking at Wikipedia right now. That's where I'm getting it.
Okay,
from.
But what was he the governor of? Was he a governor of an entire county? No, he was in charge. He was selected or elected, whatever they did back then, of a one particular compound or community of people. Okay,
right.
Community. For 140 years, the humans in this eastern part of the United States were able to get by being able to have self-governance. They selected their leaders. They selected their own rules. They said yes or no, you know. That's what you call direct and participatory democracy, all right? Direct democracy, which, by the way, scares the hell out of most politicians today. Because that takes the power away from them.
As well it should.
But But people functioned for 140 years without any overreaching, huge bureaucratic government. It's amazing. But the British, the people over in England decided, hey, those colonists, they're getting too much freedom. So they said, 1760, let's appoint a governor. Ed, what is the year in which the American Revolution happened? In 1776.
It actually started before that. We declared our independence.
But listen. The governor was appointed in 1760, and a scant 16 years later, we have a revolution. But yet, for 140 years prior to the governor, people found a way to survive, coexist, establish trade, handle disputes, all without the benefit of a big overreaching government.
And now here we are.
Isn't that amazing?
Now here we are 234 years later. I'm sorry, about 236 years later. You know, so we've actually lasted almost twice as long as they did the first time without having a revolution. Are you saying it's time for a revolution?
If that's what it takes to get these clowns out of our lives at every level, then I'm all for that. Okay, there's a pretty famous U.S. president that many of your listeners probably remember, and the president's quote was, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable." That was President John F. Kennedy that said that, and that was
yes,
in the 60s. That was in the 1960s, and we know that the 1960s had a couple periods in that decade in which there was tremendous turmoil. One of the most notable things that came out of that era were today's modern-day civil rights laws, okay, that everybody says were long overdue and were sorely needed and are trumpeted today as one of the great equalizing times in our period to make sure that all Americans, no matter their skin color, ended up having the same civil rights. Okay.
Well, what really happened in the 60s to me is a military takeover of the U.S. government. Because there's no doubt in my mind, and people call me a conspiracy theorist all the time for this, and I don't blame them, but I still believe it. Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone. John F. Kennedy was killed because he didn't want to go to Vietnam. I firmly believe that. It was a CIA hit. There's no doubt in my mind about that. That's when we lost America. I think it started in the 60s. The turmoil of the 60s set the stage for where we're at today. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to put that out there.
Okay, but the topic that you're talking about is the overreach of government into Bullitt County and the overreach by a particular department declaring that their regulations didn't need any sanctioning by the only elected body in Bullitt County, okay? And Ed, you're 100% right on that. They are clearly overreaching. They are treating regulations as if they were laws. And again, I'm not sure that all of your listeners understand that regulations are not the same as law.
They're not
the same as law because, unlike a law, regulations can be changed by any one bureaucrat by simply saying, we're changing it. And as soon as it changes, it becomes something that they claim they need to enforce. So here's the thing.
How did we get to this point, though, Paul? Because, it's, you know, as we talked about earlier, you know, we had this great independence back in 1776. You know, we were going to learn all this great things, be the greatest nation on earth. And we were at one time. I don't believe that anymore. But how do we get back to that mindset in America? Because you have the Santa Claus mentality now with the welfare state. I mean, you know, this is incredible here. But welfare spending, this is done by a study that came out of the Senate Budget Committee. Welfare spending per day per household in poverty is $168 a day. That's roughly $61,000 a year that our government is paying people not to work. Now, that is a startling number.
The good news is, at least on one sense, is that that particular shell game cannot continue. It has a limited duration. The problem with the limited duration is at the end of that, it's going to smack a whole bunch of people pretty daggone hard. And I'm not sure that today's Americans are ready to be smacked that hard. I just don't think a lot of them have got the intestinal fortitude, nor the perseverance, nor the drive and the will to survive really, really tough times. But it you're going to run out of money. Or we end up
those
South American countries where the dictators print up a whole bunch of money and it takes $10,000 $1 bills to buy a single loaf of bread. You know,
right.
I mean, those are the only outcomes possible. Those are the only, so it's since we have become, since we have collectively failed to make sure we have good leaders in place, this is what we collectively are going to get. Now, I say collectively because I'm not going to suffer that kind of fate. I have made plans to, first of all, associate with like-minded people who share values. And all of the people who are sitting there thinking the government's there to take care of them, guess what, folks? Guess what? You're on your own because the government won't be there to help you. You're gonna, if you don't know how to take care of yourself now, you will not, you will be one of the casualties. You will be one of the casualties.
Oh, I agree. I mean, that's the fascinating thing about it. I mean, you know, when we look at this spending, I mean, this is startling to me. Is when you're on welfare. Now, I'm not talking about this great, you know, you're not living high on the hog by any means, but $61,000 a year, you know, I mean, let's face the reality here. How many people in middle-class America would love to make $61,000 a year? They're not making it. The jobs that are becoming available, and oh, by the way, the government's talking about this low unemployment rate, but they're not telling you that 75% of all the people hired in the last quarter were government employees. So they're artificially deflating the unemployment rate by increasing the burden on us taxpayers. You know, there's so many things here, though, but I mean, when you look at this realistically, the median income per hour, you know, for a family is about $25. If you're a welfare recipient living in poverty, your median income is over $30. Now, I'm having a hard time trying to understand or justify what these numbers mean. Because when you throw in health care with Obamacare and things like that, I mean, those numbers are going to rise exponentially. You're going to see, you know, another $5,000 to $10,000 put out per poverty level person in health care. So now we're taking this number, raising it even higher.
Okay, well, again, they can take numbers as high as they want. There's going to be two big problems that are going to correct this issue. Number one, there's only a limited amount of money, all right? And the limited amount of people that they can continue to take it from. All the math by both sides has proven that they can sit there and they can soak the rich as much as they want. They can take every dollar that every rich person currently has, and it will not make a significant dent in the national debt as it stands today. And then they're talking about making the national debt even greater than what it is today. It cannot survive. This cannot survive. The other option is to print a whole bunch of money. Well, if they print a whole bunch of money, that's going to price American goods just totally out of the world marketplace. Just take it out of the world marketplace, okay? And if we think we got problems internationally now, wait till the dollar no longer becomes the standard on which all international trading is based on. Wait till that happens, because when the dollar becomes that unstable, there's going to be another currency that the world says we need stability in the international marketplace. The dollar is not that currency anymore. We became that currency because we had stability. We're on the doorstep of major financial instability, major. But that's okay. The system will correct itself. It's going to be extremely
But how is it going to correct itself? Because you don't have – I mean, here's the problem. The Democrats continue keeping office because they're playing Santa Claus with our money. The Republicans continue letting them keep office because the Republicans don't know how the hell to sell their product. But the reality is that the Uniparty is alive and well. It's going to take independents out there to fix this problem because the two parties are too indebted to each other. But here's what we're dealing with right now. The new fiscal year for 2013 began October the 1st, and according to the Congressional Budget Office, we had a $172 billion deficit in November alone. All right, all the way through today, we're already almost $300 billion deficit. So you're talking about a $1.6 trillion deficit, no matter what, in 2013. Now, this president, Obama, continues going out there trying to talk about higher taxes and things like that, but the higher taxes he's talking about and the people he's trying to tax don't amount to anything. The William Buffett plan, the one he talks about, the Buffett rule, $3.2 billion is all it's going to bring in against a $1.6 trillion deficit. So, you know, we know that, I know that you're right in what you're saying, and I know that we can't continue this, but how is it going to fix itself? There is no political will to do so.
This will not be a political fix. This will be the financial system, the way this country functions, will fix the problem. And there won't be any politics. That's why these two parties are right now, why they're not particularly worried about this so-called fiscal cliff, because they've already got these things. They approved these automatic cuts a long time ago. And just like, remember they were supposed to have, what was that six-person committee or 12-person committee that was supposed to come up with a whole bunch of solutions not too long ago?
Oh, Lord.
And they reached the stalemate and nothing happened?
Yeah.
Whatever it was. Whatever
it was.
It was
a Super 8, yeah.
Okay, so whatever it was, it's the same scenario that we're looking at right now. January is going to come. We're going to go over that financial, the fiscal cliff, and the cuts will take effect. The two parties are going to sit there and point fingers at one another. It's their fault. It's their fault. And in the meantime, the rest of us get soaked. But to what avail? What we get soaked for is going to be more disincentive to be a participatory member of this American society under this particular government. All it's going to do is breed more resentment, more ill will, more hostility toward the people in government that are in charge of things, and it puts us one step closer to some form of revolution. So the question becomes, is it going to be peaceful or not? Is it going to be peaceful or not? And here, going back to the thing correcting itself, just this month, in fact, I sent you the story by email. Just today, I ran across a story that reports on what has happened in California. Okay?
Actually, I'm looking at the revenue
their
loss.
Fiscal
yeah.
cliff. Yep. It seems that since the Californians, in their infinite wisdom, headed up by none other than Governor Jerry Moonbeam Brown.
Wow. And his support is Proposition 30. Go ahead. Yeah.
And so they voted themselves a tax increase because that was going to help solve the monumentally large deficit issues in California. Okay, it seems that since the November election that the revenues coming into the state coffers have decreased by $870 million, almost $1 trillion.
Well, $870 million, it's almost a billion. Well, it's almost $1 billion.
A billion, I'm talking.
And it's 10% under their monthly budget. I mean, they budget 10% more than that. Oh, I know, and that's the whole thing. Because,
so why did that happen, Ed?
Well, because when they raised the taxes, they dropped $842.5 million in personal income taxes that they lost, $187.8 million decrease in corporate taxes, and they only raised an additional $99 million in sales taxes. And this is because businesses said, "Screw you. We're going to leave. We're not going to do this."
That's correct, and that has been happening here in the United States. We've had companies and individuals who have had great wealth and who used to enjoy a prosperous business on these shores say, "I've had enough of this. This country's becoming too socialistic for me. I do not like the current environment," and so they've taken their money, and because they're wealthy, they can pick any spot on this planet in which to take their money and live quite well, I might add.
Well, what'll happen? I've often told people, you know, California is sinking into the ocean minusculely every year. I just wish that process would speed up and take a bunch of those liberals with them, because California is one of the biggest problems with the liberal laws in the United States today. But, you know, the only thing that's really going to help anybody really pay attention to that, people are so immune to hearing how bad California is financially anymore, because they've been on the brink forever. People are so immune to that the only way that's going to change is if you have Hollywood and all these damn stars and starlets out there in California leave California and tell the whole world they left because the taxes were too high. And they're not going to do that, because I guarantee you they're getting something. But here's an interesting story, though, from CNBC. Eamon Javers has some fiscal cliff talks about and everything else, and he brought in Peter Schiff, who's a Euro-Pacific Capital CEO, and Richard Brodsky, who's a Demos senior fellow. And Peter Schiff had this to say. What he said was, "I'm in the top 2%. Right now, I'm paying 45% of my total income and income taxes, both to the state of Connecticut, to the federal government, and the Medicare tax. Once the new tax hikes go into effect next year, more than half of my total income is going to go to the government. What's fair about that? I don't care what the majority voted to do. They don't have a right to steal my money just because they vote for it. So here's what the wealthy are going to do. They're going to invest more abroad. They're not going to work as hard. They're not going to pay as much in taxes. And they're not going to employ as many people. Their employees, whoever are left, are going to be the ones to pay all the taxes. And he's right. California is a good example of that, is it not?
Yeah, it is. Here, let me give you another example that is similar to that, except that this example occurred in a conversation that I had with two University of Heidelberg, Germany students back in 1997 when I was over there for a couple of weeks visiting. Okay. They were genuinely enamored at the time with the United States, and they kept asking my brother and I what life was like and what kind of taxes we paid. And we said, we told them that, you know, we thought that the taxes were pretty high back in 1997. And we told them what they were. And they said, oh, that's not very bad at all. I said, what do you mean? They said they pay more than 50% of their earned gross income to Germany or in the form of taxes for a wide variety of things. So back in 1997, we have a couple of German students who were on the verge of graduating looking to relocate out of Germany to the United States because Germany's taxes were way too high. Well, I wish I had a chance to talk with them here in 2012 because I would bet you money they would say, never mind.
Right.
Never mind. Okay, that they would that they had a change of heart. And that's what's happening here is that we're losing lots of people who are extremely talented. Many of them have lots of money. And we've got other people who are coming up through the ranks saying, I cannot afford to have half of my salary go to somebody else in the form of tax confiscation.
They're
taking
is
something that I earned away from me by force. By force.
See, I see that. If we would have started that a few years ago, I think we could have had changes a lot faster. My problem today is we're almost on a one-to-one basis. Almost 50% of Americans, at least 47% of Americans, are using welfare of some form or another. They are drawing welfare of some form or another. So it's almost a one-to-one deal. If everybody listens to this show and looks around them, count every other person, and chances are that other person is going to be drawing welfare benefits of some kind. Food stamps, Section 8, all of the above. Okay? That's always the issue.
That will fix itself because ultimately it will become too burdensome for the producers, and they will say, why am I busting my ass to keep such a paltry little amount of my earnings, and the government is forcing me to take away stuff that I rightfully earned. Ed, isn't this going back to when the Pilgrims first stepped on these shores back in 1620?
Socialism didn't work
in 1620. It doesn't work in 2012 or 13 or 14, and it's going to have the same result.
Well, if socialism and or communism was so damn good, why are all these other countries getting away from it? I mean, look at Russia. We brought down the Soviet Union.
No, we didn't bring it down. They brought themselves down, Ed.
You're right.
The Soviet system, which was, remember the old name of Russia?
Let me rephrase. The system brought them down.
The old name was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Okay?
Right.
Republics meaning individual states. They were formed the Soviet Union, but they were committed to socialism. That was the name, all right? And that collapsed because of economics more than any other factor. It can't sustain itself. And now the old Soviet Union has how many different republics operating independently? More than a dozen.
Somewhere around 10
more
or 12.
More than a dozen.
Okay.
Yeah. So socialism is doomed to fail. anyone who's listening to your show who thinks socialism is the answer, they are going to fail as soon as they no longer can get propped up by other people's money.
So how do we? So let me ask you this.
We don't.
We let it happen.
No, we just let it happen.
I appreciate that. Do you see this happening anytime soon? And what I mean by soon is this something that's going to happen, like, say, the next 5-10 years? Or is this going to be passed on down the road even further, where it's going to be a lot worse for our kids and our grandkids?
I think that with the current situation we have in Washington, D.C., I can see it coming within the next 4 to 6 years. I think we can reach a crisis. The first crisis is going to be in January when we go over that fiscal cliff.
Okay. And you really think we're going to go over the fiscal cliff?
Oh, yeah. I think that these people in Washington set that up months ago when they put those built-in, when they programmed those cuts, those automatic cuts. They did that by design. This is all by design. All by design. So we're going to go over that fiscal cliff, and everybody's going to, all they're going to do in Washington is sit there, and each side's going to blame the other. And if people think we've got dysfunctional Congress right now, wait till January gets here. Now, in a crisis like that, Ed, now think about this. In a crisis like that, what has to happen to put a clamp on the crisis? A leader must come forward with the power and authority to deal with the crisis.
But who do we have as a leader today?
Let's call this leader that's going to come to save us from this crisis. Let's call this leader, a messiah.
Well, we've already elected the messiah for a second term. Ask anybody.
We did not. Don't you blame the good people in Indiana and Kentucky. Indiana and Kentucky said, no way, Jose, do they want this guy.
This is a national show. We'll talk overall. I understand that. But, we look at things like today, for example. Let's look at the former Republican governor of Florida. You know who Charlie Crist is, right?
The former Republican governor in two ways today.
Exactly.
He used to be a Republican.
Exactly. He just decided he's a Democrat. He went in and switched to a Democrat, so he's basically screwed everybody over to GOP in Florida. But now he's a Democrat. Now he's trying to say he's always been a Democrat, just finally realized it. Of course, throughout many years, he's always proclaimed himself to be a Ronald Reagan Republican, things like that. And he abandoned his pro-life, pro-gun principles after 2010 because, to me, this is sour grapes. This is a guy who couldn't get elected as a senator, as a Republican, because he didn't do his job as a governor in Florida. He didn't do a good job as a governor. He lost an election for senator. So, now he decided to try to be a Democrat. This guy, the turncoat. So, once again, to me, Charlie Crist is an example of everything wrong with the party people today. I don't see anybody that's going to be able to step forward and be that leader that you're talking about. Maybe I'm wrong.
Executive orders can be used for a lot of different things, Ed.
Well, I appreciate that. I hope you're right, but I just don't see that leader that you're talking about.
I'm not right.
Well, no. I know what you're saying, because Obama has no problem whatsoever signing an executive order and assuming rights and dictatorship that he has no right constitutionally to have. And I could see him. I'll be honest with you. There was a lot of some way out there conspiracy theorists who said that if Obama didn't win in November, he was going to sign an executive order throwing out the election and declaring himself emperor, which I laughed about, obviously. But, that doesn't mean he's not willing to take a power grab. I mean, let's look at Egypt and what's going on over there right now. And I think that that's setting the stage for what Obama may try here. It's going to be very interesting. Paul, I appreciate you calling in, my friend. We are out of time. As always, it's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much. For you guys who are listening, thanks for joining us on the Ed Springsteen Show. Remember, we air every night on the EVM Radio Network, Sunday through Thursday at 7 p.m. Right here. You can check out our podcast either on iTunes. You can go to Stitcher.com, Louisville Politics there. We are now on Stitcher. And you can go to the website at LouisvillePolitics.com. or edspringsteen.com and download the latest show. Make sure you tell your friends. For you advertisers who may be looking to advertise, I don't know why you guys are spending money on 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning ads on a cable TV station nobody's watching. It's funny to me. You can advertise right here at NVM for a lot less money. You're going to get more publicity out of it than you're ever going to get with your advertising platform now. Give us a call. It's 502-742-8519 or 502-417-5383, and we will help set you up on an advertising plan that's not only affordable but beneficial for you and your business. In the meantime, folks, that is a wrap. Have a great night. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow night. Ed Martin should be back. I know he's in Pennsylvania on business. He actually texted me during the show. He had a last-minute emergency. Of course, Barack Obama built his business, but he's out there working his butt off trying to keep it alive. So we'll see you then. Thank you very much.